howls over a post-apocalyptic hellscape inhabited by mutos, dregs, primords. Field Major Steyr of the Sontaran Empire and the bandaged-faced traffic warden from Threads. You shelter below ground, waiting for rad levels to drop to safe levels. Alone, with nothing more than minimal food rations. And somewhat improbably, 5 stories from the Doctor Who universe in any medium. TV, audio, film, novel, comic book. These artifacts, they'll be your only link to the past. Maybe for the rest of your life. Welcome to The Bunker, a Doctor Who podcast from Cutaway Comics. Brought to you by Bamalan Productions. And now, here's your host, Ian Winterton.
Hello, welcome to The Bunker. This is the bit where usually I sort of read awkwardly from a sort of pre-written intro. But with me today is Barnaby Eaton-Jones, who I've never met before, but we have loads of things and people in common, not just Doctor Who. And it's great to meet you over this internet connection, Barnaby. But I would just say, you have done so many things. You're an award-winning audio writer, director, and publisher, and you have chin beard and spiteful puppet. But could you describe yourself? Because you've done so many things.
Somebody asked me this the other day about what do you do as a job? And I said, I do lots of things as a job. So I assume I would say I was a creative, but I did used to say I was I would never say that I was a polymath, because I trotted out the standard, that's not a parrot that does long division.
It makes you sound like you think you're Leonardo da Vinci.
Yeah. I basically get bored very easily. So I leap from, I do one thing and go, I think I've done that okay. So I'll go to something else that I can do okay. And I never get very good at anything, which is a cunning ploy of mine. So that I just have to learn new things all the time.
But you're always learning, which is it's a sort of tenet of Buddhism. I'm not a Buddhist or anything, but my friend is. And actually always learning things is one of the keys to human happiness, supposedly.
My daughter is named Dharma, which is a Buddhist thing. So not that we were Buddhist. Hilariously, when people get a very, ask a very deep question about why you named your daughter Dharma, we say, well, we used to watch Dharma and Greg, the American TV sitcom. quite like the name. But that's terrible, isn't it?
That's cool. What a lovely name. Although it makes me think of, is it The Dharma Bums by Kerouac?
We have that book. So it must have been filtering through everything, right? It means the truth and light of all things. And we thought that was quite a nice, meaning for it. So
that's awesome. And she's very likely to get teased.
Kerouac
movie. A Kerouac book. But anyway, we ended up talking about Buddhism right at the beginning.
Always good.
Yeah. But that's we're here for a Doctor Who podcast, and we've started talking about. I think that sort of sums up how many different things you've done, and you still haven't told me all the things you do.
Oh, sorry. I just do lots of stuff. I'm basically the least famous Barnaby in the Doctor Who world, because there's obviously Barnaby Edwards and Barnaby Kay, and there seems to be a glut of Barnabys, which is worrying. I think at one point on Twitter, Barnaby Edwards suggested we should do the 3 Barnabys as a Doctor Who type.
Which one would be the dandy and which one would be the clown?
Well, exactly. I wouldn't wish to say.
I always think of Barnaby the Bear, but I'm from my childhood. Because I think I was born in 1972. Are you a little bit younger than me?
By a year, so I...
Oh, just by a year, because I was just thinking your influences of all the things you do and your choices here in the 5 choices here basically make me go, that's someone who's definitely my generation. Because you've done things with the goodies. I mean, I love my audio too, and, your influences from Radio 4 seem to be like mine are as well. Like, you've grown up on that era of comedy. You know, I bet if I say the words Willie Rushton to you, you go, oh, Willie Rushton. Because I loved Willie Rushton as a kid.
Yeah. Just, he was brilliant, wasn't he?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I haven't a clue. Is the panel game that he was in, well, the panel game, unlike any other panel game.
It
was just a Sunday staple around the dinner table listening to. I think we used to listen to, oddly, tapes of it that we bought, audio tapes of it as well, and listen to that. So, but yeah, no, I think Barnaby the Bear, which you just mentioned, was actually premiered in 1973. So most of my family assumed I was named after that, which wasn't the case at all. But there you go.
Yeah, wow, those early 70s. Well, I mean, this Doctor Who and Doctor Who fans, it is a lot about your connection to childhood. And seems to me from all the different things you do, you seem to be driven by, not just by childhood, but by passions, things you're interested in. And would you say everything starts from a point of being a fan of all the different things?
Yeah. And yeah, you're right, that's true. And it's that, it's sort of, I'm certainly not obsessive about stuff, but unless it comes to comedy, when I'm quite sort of, I wouldn't call myself a comedy historian, but there's so much stuff in there that, you know, that I learnt or listened to and kept hold of. But I think because I was unwell at about 17, 18 and ended up being bedbound for about 2 years and then sort of never really properly recovered, I do sort of feel like I missed out on the growing up bit where everybody went to university. And so I'm still quite childish in the sense that I've stuck around the age of 17 when you're sort of, you know, all the stuff that informs you around that age, which, you know, if you want to be a writer, if you want to be an actor, if you want a comedian, you end up sort of aping those things that you watch before you find your own voice. And I think that's what sort of happened. So Doctor Who was, and I was able to watch and read and listen to a lot of stuff because I was stuck doing nothing else. So it just meant that I suppose all those things became stronger. So
especially you had a lockdown experience 30 years before lockdown.
I was ready for it when it arrived.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of us who are in this sort of field, lockdown was actually, I mean, you don't want to say it was nice, but because it was very stressful as well. Yeah. But at the same time, we were much, much better prepared to be in a room talking to people on screens, recording stuff over clean feed and all that sort of stuff. Whereas other people went, I absolutely have no coping mechanism and had to really learn how to be in their own house. Whereas,
and be surrounded by everybody all the time. It's quite an odd thing, but. I always hesitate to say it was a nice experience because it wasn't for so many people. But but I was very lucky in that, you know, I could continue doing what I love doing. So
I think there were definitely lots of positives to it. I mean, yeah, I think maybe we'll look back on it like people do World War II. Like, did you have a good war? Did you have a bad war? And I had a good pandemic because lots of things happened. Yeah. I kept working remotely. You know, in fact, more things happened because of the pandemic.
Yeah.
You know, with comics and all these things that, you know, that were
amazing,
able to happen.
Yeah.
And also, I didn't have to worry about freaking out and going out into the world and all that complicated stuff. It was like life became very simple. Just knuckle down. I quite liked it. I did also go a bit nuts, like lots of people did. But anyway, so Doctor Who. Because we're focusing in on that, we might talk about Robin of Sherwood and things later. Because you're an uber Robin of Sherwood person as well, aren't you?
I've stolen lots of, you know, nostalgic TV series and put them on audio. That's basically what I did.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you have that in common with Gareth at Cutaway Comics. You know, you're a hoover of IP that you love. and that's kind of what Gareth does as well. You know, and that's what's behind Cutaway Comics. But we'll talk about Robin of Sherwood stuff a bit later when we move on to talking more about your audio stuff. But what's your Doctor Who origin story then? I imagine it's much like mine in that it's always been there and it was Tom Baker.
Yeah. It was the very last episode of Tom Baker because my dad. I remember my dad saying, "You need to come and watch this, the last story." I think it was rather than last episode, because this is the sort of moment where you know you'll see something exciting happen. And so I don't really remember the last story of Tom Baker that well, but I know that he did that. I remember having a discussion with him about it. So sort of Peter Davison is etched in my memory as my doctor.
Oh, that's interesting because. Mm. Yeah, because my memories are really early Tom Baker, like as a 5-year-old. So that's actually isn't like mine at all. So Logopolis is your first.
Yeah, Logopolis.
Sit down. Yeah, yeah. Sit yeah. down and watch this.
Which was very confusing.
Change. Yeah. So... at least you haven't spent the rest of your life going, "Why did they change the doctor? Because he's always been Tom Baker and always should be."
Yeah.
At least that was the deal going in.
No, that's true. But it is weird, isn't it? Because you sort of feel like, because having gone back and watched obviously everything and read everything, I guess I was probably reading Target novels of the Fourth Doctor, you know, at the same time as watching Peter Davison. And so you sort of feel like you watched that as well, even though you didn't. It's a very odd thing. But I just know that my formative Doctor was Peter Davison, and then. Sort of leading into Colin Baker, so but it was but it became like a massive passion. So so that's I remember subjecting my sister to the Five Doctors, and she has never.
Yeah.
How we used to spend our time leaping in the air around the living room, pretending to be the Rast and Warri Robot. I probably was way too old to be doing that. So but
that's another thing all Doctor Who fans having. In common, as we all shave a few years off our anecdotes. Yeah, yeah, I was 15 actually in real life, but I'm not telling anyone that. But yeah, because I was going to put Androids of Tara as your first choice because it's 1978, yeah. But actually, you didn't watch it live on the podcast.
No, as far as I know,
so Five Doctors is your choice. So if we launch into that, as your Raston robot,
yeah. So, nothing new to say about the Five Doctors. The other people have said much better.
It's fine, but it's I guess it's more about your memories. So I guess in your childhood, you'd actually those being a fan from the beginning of Davison. By the time you get to 83, I guess that felt like you were properly locked in and slightly obsessed with Doctor Who. And now it was all the Doctors. So great experience. Yeah.
Incredibly exciting. When was the Five Faces of Doctor Who? Was that
That was the build up to. I thought it was 83 until I started doing these podcasts and talking to much wiser fans than I. but it was actually to get everyone ready for Peter Davison,
right?
But then they also had stuff. And they also had stuff when the 30th was coming up,
right?
So a lot of people saw things in 81. I think.
Yeah, I think I probably saw some of that, but it was fascinating. The Five Doctors was just, and it's the weirdest thing because it is my favorite Doctor Who thing. I know, you know, people moan about anniversary stories and say they're weaker and, you know, nobody gets the chance to shine and et cetera, et cetera. But the Five Doctors is just such an amazing celebration of the history. Apart from poor old Richard Herndl, who shoved into a part which he didn't quite own, I don't feel. And then weirdly, I said this to somebody the other day, I wonder whether Stephen Moffat remembered Richard Herndl rather than William Hartnell, because his writing of the First Doctor is more angry and sexist, more like the Richard Herndl type of very angry First Doctor than William Hartnell was. So it's a strange thing, because if we all grew up around the same time, the Five Doctors as our tent pole, it might have, I don't know, who knows, but he will, I'm sure, deny that, and so that's just rubbish. And so,
just wrote an angry William Hartnell, angry sexist William Hartnell for the hell of it.
Yes, just his comment on the 1960s. So it was... And it's one I always return to, and it's the weirdest thing, because I did go around conventions doing Doctor Who comedy shows where we would write it for the Evening Entertainment, and a lot of them would be based on the Five Doctors, because it was just So I suppose it's the one that everybody remembers the most, and it's such a nice template to introduce. You know, if you're mucking about with it, you can add more doctors in it, et cetera, so so it's quite a good one, and it is the most quotable story. Well, I find I drop quotes into normal conversation and see whether people notice, but it's terrible, really.
I had Joe Lidster on the second one of these, and he picked the
Yeah.
five doctors, and it was a random line from Tegan. Oh, what was it? Oh
Not
God,
the
what was
entry decoder
it?
one.
It's an entry decoder,
Yeah.
and that
Like,
was
how
that
does she
was
know?
And so I was there going, when the power of the doctor was on, going, yeah, fuck them talking about Adric. I want to hear her. I want to, that's the fan service I want. I want just a random line where she goes, it's an entry
Yeah.
decoder.
Yeah, and that's when I always bring up, but also recently, and I don't know why, it's the bit where the Yeti is attacking the Second Doctor and the Brigadier, and the Brigadier just randomly says, "You've maddened it." And so whatever, if anybody gets angry, I basically just throw that into the conversation, and nobody knows what I'm talking about, but it
You've
amuses me
maddened
greatly. So, yeah. Is it you've
it.
maddened it or you've angered it? I can't remember, but
Oh,
it
fantastic.
is corking.
So that's the five doctors, which gets picked quite a lot actually, but I think that's because
Yeah.
people really take the if I could only watch five things, have five things of Doctor Who, at
Yeah.
least I've got a lot of doctors in the five
Yeah.
doctors as well.
Yeah.
But it really, for our generation, it really was like a proper hit. This we kind of knew the show existed before we were alive, and here it
Yeah.
was, still harking, still having that thread, which is why I think Power of the Doctor
Yeah.
was so nice. Yeah, that was the
Yeah.
modern version of that, because lots of people who were, our kind of age, we're going, oh, like the modern fans aren't bothered about that, and the casual viewer will be mystified. And it's like, no, the casual view, there's a reason the
Yeah.
tabloids can fill a double page spread by just mentioning Doctor Who rumours,
Yeah.
because even if people aren't fans, they're still kind of, it's part of British culture. They're
Yeah,
still interested
absolutely.
in it. Everybody knows who the companions are, even if they've never
Yeah.
watched Doctor Who. It's kind of that kind of part of our psyche, isn't it?
Is.
Which is why I think Power of the Doctor,
Brilliant, yeah.
my kids, that my middle kid's 13, and he's never
Yeah.
that bothered about Doctor Who because I kind of forced it on him, and then
Yeah.
he was rebelled, and suddenly he went, Dad, did you see Power of the Doctor? It was amazing. And they love watching all these videos of Easter eggs. Like, kids love Easter
Yeah.
eggs and finding out what the Easter eggs are after they've watched it.
Yeah. Well, that's the weird thing. That's how my daughters got into Doctor Who, because I purposefully didn't try and get them into it, or say, "Oh, you should watch this," or whatever, because they didn't just seem that interested in that type of thing. And then randomly, because they used to watch behind the scenes videos, and so we would watch something, and they'd always go, "Oh, that's done with green screen or whatever," and I'd be saying, "No, just invest in the story. Don't keep telling me how it's done. Invest in watching it." But then my youngest just randomly started watching Doctor Who on BBC iPlayer, and then brought my eldest into it, and then they became obsessed, and so it was a lovely sort of transition from them from not really caring about it and wondering why I had a load of police boxes in the downstairs toilet, and then suddenly becoming,
Oh wow.
wanting to dress up and wanting to be the 10th and 11th Doctor. And
Oh well, what era was that then? Was that Tennant or Eccleston
yeah,
or?
the youngest one did Tennant, I think, started with Tennant, and then the eldest one started with Matt Smith. So weirdly, because they happen to start with those, that is their favourite Doctors. So they have gone back and watched others, and I love the fact that they describe others before they really sort of knew. They said Colin Baker, "Is that the one that looks like Willy Wonka?" Sort of. And so they would randomly. So they watched the Five Doctors, that my youngest watched the Five Doctors the other day, and found it fascinating. And so it was nice to, because it's sort of it's quite a jovial, it's a weird word to use, but it's sort of a happy story, even though it's, quite dark and sinister, the motive behind it. But it's just, as it is a celebration, it sort of comes across like that. So she was, she wanted to know what the, what's the bouncing kangaroos bit that Patrick Troughton ad libs in the Brigadier. The Great and Terrible Zodin, or whatever it was.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
A random thing that he obviously said. She said, where can I see Zodin? You can't see Zodin. So that's just a random ad lib.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, no, it's brilliant.
Something's coming. A threat like no other. It will take a team of the most unlikely warriors in creation to defeat it. The universe is depending on you. On you! On you!
Coming soon from Cutaway Comics, Phase 1 of an epic new saga, Gods and Monsters. Issue 1, Faustine, Princess of Tharin, written by Stephen Gallagher, with art by Martin Geraghty. Issue 2, Sutekh the Heretic, written by Ian Winterton, with art by Adrian Salmon. And Issue 3, Omega Eltrella, by Mark Griffiths, with art from the legendary John Ridgway. An epic clash of good and evil that threatens to rip apart time and space. Coming soon. Follow us on Twitter at Cutaway Universe or visit cutawaycomics.co.uk.
I was thinking, because I was, get back to Androids of Tara, but I'm almost thinking, we've mentioned New Who, so one of your choices is Midnight.
Yeah.
The amazing Midnight. So did you watch this? You watched this obviously on transmission, and then a few years later, did you get to relive it with your kids?
I did, and sort of that's why I chose it, because watching on transmission, I watched it with my wife, who's also a Doctor Who fan, and she and we were both sort of freaked out by it, and it was the performances were so powerful, and the message behind it of the mob mentality and the, you know, the power of words and or not having words was so brilliant that we were just mesmerized by it and pretty sort of. You know, it is quite a freaky story, especially when you sort of watch it with the lights out in the evening, whatever. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, oh, this would be a great one to. And I actually said to my youngest, I don't know whether you want to watch this because it's actually quite spooky and I don't want you being up half the night worried about stuff. They found it quite amusing. They didn't find it scary or freaky. And I couldn't work out why. And I didn't want to, you know, say during the thing, but I just guess because they're so clued up about everything that goes on behind the scenes of stuff, they're quite analytical when they watch stuff. And I don't know whether that's the same with other people's children as well. But so they don't. There's like a barrier between them.
We had to turn. We watched Midnight a few weeks ago with my 7-year-old who really loves Doctor Who, and we had to turn it off because it was intense.
Yeah. No, mine was. I think my daughter was about 9.5 when she got into Doctor Who. She's only been in sort of 6 months, more than six, you know, she's only 10.5 now, but so that was the youngest. So yeah, and I wouldn't have, if they'd have asked, I'd have said, you can't watch it until you're a bit older. But the great thing about the story is the fact that it came out of necessity, the fact that they didn't have enough budget, let's do a one set enclosed story. And although Donna is one of my favourite companions, certainly my favourite of the Tennant era. It's the fact that she isn't in it, or just sort of top and tails it, somehow makes it even better because she sort of often would bring sort of a humorous element to stuff, and it is quite a dark and serious sort of thing, isn't it, really? But
And Russell T. Davis wrote it so quickly, didn't he? If the story is to be believed, which I think it is.
Yes.
So warts and all.
In an hour.
Yeah.
But I think you being a writer as well, you'll know that sometimes things just do pour out of you. And they just, if you're on a particular role, you can do stuff incredibly well, whereas other times it takes weeks and weeks and weeks. But I just find it a brilliant... I don't think it's not, weirdly, I wouldn't hold it up as like, if you've never seen Doctor Who and you know you want to get into David Tennant, watch this one. But for me, it's just a nice one to come back to and be scared all over again, and be scared whilst my children aren't scared, which is always lovely. So we can do a role reversal there.
yeah. It's such a phenomenal script. I wasn't actually anything to do with this production, but I was doing other things at the same time for the 50th. Gareth ran the pub in Manchester at the time, which he doesn't anymore. And part of his thing was he asked Russell's permission to do a live version of Midnight. And he said yes, fine, which is, I don't know if that would happen now. But he said yes, fine, as long as he's Mr. Smith and not the Doctor.
I remember that. I remember it being advertised.
And it was quite a thing because I was in on rehearsals and stuff, and it was quite a thing to gave me an extra appreciation of quite how amazing those actors are.
Yeah,
like they must have in a way loved it, because it's a massive challenge. But I know our actor Zoe, who played Sky, you know, she did such an amazing job, and having to do it live with no takes or anything, and they didn't miss a beat. You know, they did it. It was so intense in like a small black box.
Incredible. Theater.
Loads of people in, and they didn't miss a beat of it. And it was such a good, it really gave me an extra appreciation of what a tight, amazing script it is.
Yeah. A great idea to do it live as well, because there is that tension that builds and builds and builds, and to have that with the atmosphere of an audience present, it's brilliant. So
No, it was a special thing, and as with a lot of things from that era, I don't know if it would be allowed now, because I think Gareth said Russell said that he slightly got told off. I mean, I don't know how much you can tell Russell T. Davies off, but he got slightly told off for giving permission. But he also keeps the flying monkeys away. It's like, leave them alone. They're great fans and brilliant. No one's making much money. It's fine. But it gets a bit different when you are making money. And then suddenly everything has to be tight as a drum, legal-wise. Yeah. So moving on from Midnight, I'm going to go for Androids of Tara. When did you watch that?
Yeah.
The Androids of Tara, 1978. Why this out of all the Toms? I mean, I'm not saying that because I don't like Androids of Tara. I think it's amazing. but why Androids of Tara?
Well, it's a weird one, really, because this is a very controversial opinion, but I don't particularly like Mary Tam as Romana. I don't think she showcases... I've seen her other stuff where she acts perfectly well, but it's a quite a wooden performance. And because Androids of Tara involves androids, where she gets to be her doubles and her android stuff, it works very well that way. But no, that's a terrible... You know, I'm not dismissing her acting. Like I said, I've seen her in other stuff where she's fine, but there's something about she doesn't quite click with the role. But it is a great written, a well-written role, and it should have been a lovely one to continue. But obviously... You know, it's the weirdest thing because there's so much to choose from Tom Baker, and that it's sort of like whatever you pick, you're going to have good things in it because he always provided good value. But I actually like the fact that it's nothing to do with the overall arc of the series about collecting the crystals. I've completely forgotten what it is now. But
the key to time.
Sorry, yeah.
I mean. We've established you didn't watch it on transmission. I don't think, looking at what era it was, I don't think I had this thought about the transmission. Like you were saying about the Target novels and your viewing merging together. But I remember at some point, probably from the Target novels, really not liking the Key to Time bollocks, because it is a bit go and collect all the Horcruxes, bad kind of it's a really obvious quest that has that's just silly as well.
I absolutely love the fact that she finds it within like 2 minutes at the start.
I wonder if that was the writer going, I hate this. Have I got to do this? Okay, she's going to find it, and it's just going to sit there in a kitchen.
And then this
is a plot that I wrote last year that that we're going to have anyway. I've had this idea for ages. I'm not going to go overboard trying to fit the key to time in it. Because they even set some stuff up like, what's happened to the statue? You know, yeah. Well, some people might be worried about that because of their superstitious fools. Yeah. But actually, we'll never refer to this again.
Nothing happens. Yeah. Now, David Fisher's he wrote some great stuff. And The Creature from the Pit.
I like The Creature from the Pit. I like that whole era, but I think a lot of it might be to do with it. That's the era when I really remember coming on stream as a sentient being and a Doctor Who fan.
Yeah, I mean, The Angels of Tara is a bit like it could sit in that series because it is sort of frantic and funny and silly. And it's just got, it's got some great quotable lines. I just adore the bit with the electric sword when the Fourth Doctor is having a nap under his hat and he hits the brim and it sort of sparks and he does that, you know. Will you stop standing on my chest, please? My hat's on fire. Great.
But it's also got the immortal line, made more immortal because of the, I don't know if you're aware of the Hamster with a Blunt Penknife podcast.
You should listen
to that. It's the lovely Joe, and I keep nudging him. He says, "Keep nudging me," and I keep nudging him, and it keeps not happening. But my choice of commentary for that, if I ever get on it, is to do Midnight. So I'm penciled in to do. But yeah, it's just such a lovely commentary podcast. I'd really recommend it.
It has
lots and lots of people we'll all know from fandom talking and laughing a lot over every era of Doctor Who. there's hundreds of episodes on there now. But yeah, his thing is, it has that quote from Androids of Tara. Hamster with a blunt penknife, do it quicker.
Oh, that's right.
And it's,
that's the weirdest thing, though, isn't it? About I think that if you're a true Doctor Who fan, you get licensed to be able to take the mick out of it because you love it so much. The weirdest thing going around doing the Doctor Who comedies was the very first ones we did, where we did a sketch show. We sort of did a sort of generic sketch show that shoehorned Doctor Who in it, and the only sketch that really worked properly, I mean, I think they were all funny in their own right, but obviously when you're playing to an audience of Doctor Who fans, what they really want to see is you taking them out of the stories that they've already seen. So we had one sketch which was supposed to be an extra Key to Time thing, and they really reacted amazingly to it, and from that moment I just thought, that we have to go this way when we're writing stuff. And so that was always really interesting, and you just, as long as you weren't nasty about it. It was coming from a place of love, and that stuff that they understood. It was really nice it sort of never failed because you were just doing jokes within a framework of stuff they already knew. So to add the extra context of humour on it was really, really nice. Although we did get a very irate fan after a Colin Baker sketch. We did a sketch.
An irate Doctor Who fan?
I know, it's just impossible, isn't it? But we had a Sixth Doctor meeting the Sontarans and Michael Gray sketch, which was only a really short sketch. And afterwards, when we came off stage, some fan pinpointed our Sixth Doctor sort of almost like pushed him against the wall, and said, now, that was completely wrong. And so our Sixth Doctor was not a great Doctor Who fan. He was just an actor friend that was coming along. And he went, what was wrong? And he said, well, you're wearing the wrong colour polka dot necktie for the Sontaran meeting. It wouldn't have been that colour. It would have been the other colour. So out of all of that, we thought, did you find it funny? Well, it sort of threw me because of the colour of the polka dot tie.
Oh, no.
Yeah, so our attention to detail wasn't as good as it should have been.
No, because during the 50th, I wrote 50 Years in 50 Rails that Gareth put on at a few cons, and that was very much... I mean, I'm writing this thing, but it's so specific. And it's like, that's a lot of work for something that can only work at a Doctor Who convention. But it was good fun for the 50th. But yeah, the laughs were the ones where you were, you know, if you weren't a fan, you know, I had like First Doctor when Susan starts, right at the beginning when Susan starts saying, I've called it Time and Relative Dimensions in Space. And I have to have the First Doctor go, stop saying that, Susan. It's a phrase widely used in Time Lord Society. And all that sort of thing. And and just and loads of little jokes about continuity all the way through it, and they got the biggest laughs. But it was
It is weird, isn't it?
I
did 40 years and 40 minutes, which was at the 40th Panopticon thing, and so that was very similar. But I just remembered throwing in one ad lib, which I thought would absolutely slay the house, which was that somebody on stage was forgot their line, so they kept repeating the same line to try and get back to where they were, and I was behind the stage, so I just shouted out, "It's chronic hysteresis," like really loud, thinking that would be hilarious. That, tumbleweeds, just nothing. I shouted it as loud as I could, and everybody went, "Yeah, that's not funny, is it?" and carried on, and I thought, right, I'm not going to, I'll have to be careful about living in Doctor Who comedies anymore. But there we go. The Androids of Tara, anyway.
Yeah, the Androids of Tara.
It's a great story.
Yeah, when did you first see it? So, when you were quite young, or
I don't know. I think I bought the box set of the Keith Simon on VHS when it came out because it was very pretty as well. So I just thought, that's a nice box set. And so I think it was probably then, which I don't know when that was, but I gravitated because I did mostly comedy stuff. So the funnier the Doctor Who stuff was more interesting at that time to me. So I would enjoy, the sort of throwaway stuff that Tom Baker was doing and that they clearly were, going a little bit silly with the stuff. And so I think that's probably why I liked it so much, because it was, and plus I do write spoofs of things. So, the fact it was a Prison of Xander's spoof as well was quite good, which is lovely, isn't it? Because if you write a spoof thing, you already have the plot and the template, so it's sort of half your work done for you. But I just found it.
It very much leans into that spoof. It doesn't hide it at all, does it? Because it's even got like a moustache and
it is.
It looks very much.
even with the swords, and there's just a little electric tip on the end, and that's fine. But I found it. It is, and I'm sure other people will say it's a very throwaway story, and it's a very, there's not a lot to it in a sense. And it's a story that's been done. The doubles thing has been done many times in literature and TV. But I find it just because it was, something you're supposed to take with you in the bunker. I found that it would be a nice sort of refreshing, light sort of story to watch rather than something a bit heavier. I've got Midnight, so that scared the life out of me. So
now Androids of Tara as a chaser. And, but I wondered if it's because the wonderful Peter Jeffrey is in it, because if he wasn't in it, I think if his part was played by someone less huge as an actor, then maybe it wouldn't be such a watchable thing. Although it is very
watchable. You're right. There's a couple of underplayed roles in it, which you just think, you're just underplaying it too much. It needs to be at the Peter Jeffrey level. And he's not overplaying it, but he's just so perfectly...
Because I love Peter Jeffrey. But I wondered, because I know, I see from my research, you've written books on the Avengers, haven't you?
No, I think I contributed to a book.
Oh, contributed.
Yeah.
Is that a fandom that you're part of, though?
Well, weirdly, no. But it was the weirdest thing.
That's good, because me neither. Because it's been one of those things that I'm slightly agnostic about. A bit The Prisoner as well. Doctor Who fans love The Prisoner and love Avengers. And I'm like, all right. I don't like James Bond either. So
there's a list of things that it's just Doctor Who. No, the Avengers was weird because my dad loved it and I never watched it. And I bought the box set thinking, I'll watch it. He just passed away. So I thought, I'll watch the Avengers properly. And then Alan Hayes, who was doing the Avengers book, said, can you write something like an essay for the Avengers? And I said, well, I've never watched it properly. I've watched like clips and... But so I know, I mean, we can talk about it in the conversation because of the ability to appear that I've watched more stuff than I actually have. and so I wrote an essay about, the joy of coming, or the supposed joy of coming to the Avengers, completely fresh when you're older. But I still haven't watched it, gone through it properly. It is one of those sort of a dip in and out series. But
I've barely ever watched any, to be honest. But for me, Peter Jeffrey is... He's solidified as Cromwell in By the Sword Divided.
Yeah.
Because that was something we watched as a family. And also, because my dad was a BBC employee, we had a really like life-changing visit to BBC TV Centre, and we watched Grange Hill being filmed, saw Roland in the cafeteria eating a donut, which is just bizarre. Roland Browning eating a donut. We watched Grange Hill being filmed, and then we walked through the Bladder, saw Divided sets.
Oh, wow.
Which were just, you know, which was just magical. And then I just never forget, there was a broken Dalek, all this crap.
Right.
There was a broken Dalek. And then there was a TARDIS, and I ran into it and kind of expected it to be bigger on the inside. And I've just realized, looking at it, I must have been, again, quite old, because this was doing about 84. So I was like 12. It's not like I was 5. I just remember running in and it just being full of spiders, and like the black cloth was like hanging down, and I just got a mouthful of dust and cobwebs. But the magic of television, you know, a bit like you were saying about your daughters, like I've always loved the fact that you can tell it's fake.
Yeah, yeah. It's weird, but
your imagination.
But it's that fascinating thing about the TARDIS where you do believe. And I think that I remember going to Longleat where they'd built the TARDIS over the front door of that massive building, which was, I mean, obviously pretty obvious. But when you're a kid and you go through the TARDIS doors and then suddenly you're into a humongous space at the Longleat exhibition, that was a great idea to do, because it, you know, it gave you that sense of, oh gosh, it seems quite real. But I still do that with any, you know, if we're at a convention and there's a police box there, you just always assume it's going to be bigger when you go in. It's not. As I've got bigger over the years, it's actually difficult to get into them, so I'm thinking I wish it was bigger. So
yeah, well, it's weird that have you seen that video that's going around of the Harry Styles movie where he's a policeman in the 60s?
Yeah,
and loads of people are just going, why is he coming out of a TARDIS? Like, loads of younger people are like, I know what Doctor Who is and I like Harry Styles, but why is he coming out of a TARDIS?
What's the connection?
And it is really weird looking at it going, oh yeah, that's an actual thing, isn't it? That's why it's a police box.
that's amazing. What an amazingly powerful thing to have. Everybody from the area would know it was a police box, and now everybody knows it as Doctor Who's time traveling machine. It's just an amazing sort of weird thing that in the zeitgeist sort of thing, but collective consciousness of it's not a police box anymore.
No, it's very strange, but it's again some more of the casual genius that is Doctor Who.
You're listening to The Bunker from Cutaway Comics, publisher of creator-owned comics based on characters and stories set in the Doctor Who universe. For more on Cutaway, visit cutawaycomics.co.uk or follow us on Twitter at Cutaway Universe.
So your next choice is a book, because you were allowed anything. It's a book by David Howe and Stephen James Walker, The Doctor Who, The Television Companion from 1998. Which I have never seen or read, and I've today looked at its TARDIS wiki entry. I take it it's a wonderful artifact, because
it's a very fat artifact. That's I use it as instead of weights when I it was my Bible. So when I was writing these Doctor Who comedies, I stupidly said that any convention that wanted to book us, because we were a little travelling theatre group, I would write something original for each one. So whether it was a sketch show or a full-length play or a shorter play, I stupidly said that. And because there were so many conventions in a short space of time over the time we were doing it, I was just continually writing Doctor Who, trying to think of new stuff, you know, and how, what can we do for this one? Who's the guest? Can we do something that relates to the guests? So that book was basically my Bible, because it was really easy to pick out quotes from it that we could mangle or look at. I can't quite remember what that storyline, how that goes. And so you look it up through there. And then it would also, because it gave you, you know, gaffes and interesting facts about things, that you could then throw those in. I mean, I remember writing a whole sketch around, you know, Hartnell being an irascible sergeant major most of the time in whatever role he was playing, and you know, come and then there's a sort of twinkly, impish grandfather. So we did a sketch called Just William, where he comes in and he's a very erudite sort of John Gielgud-y type, you know, actor saying, "You know, my darlings, what do you want me to do?" And there's Donald Tosh, who famously loved bunking off to go and do cricket and stuff, watch cricket. So they're trying to get him to be this sort of stammering, you know, forgetful old man. He's playing it very Larry Olivier. And then Donald Tosh, who's practicing his cricket strokes, accidentally whacks him over the head with the cricket bat. And when he wakes up, obviously he's completely befuddled and starts, you know, being William Hart, being the First Doctor. And they go, "That's it, that's exactly what we want." And that just came from, you know, reading the back story of stuff in that book. And
that is a very niche sketch.
It was incredibly, and hilariously, who was there? Mark Gatiss was there in the audience right at the back. And none of, because it was quite not a parody sketch, the audience was sort of chuckling away and getting where we were going with it, but they weren't really sort of finding it hilarious. But the convention organizer said that at the end, Mark turned to him and said, "That's the funniest sketch I've ever seen about Doctor Who." I don't know whether he was being sarcastic or being genuine, but
he wasn't being sarcastic. Definitely, Barnaby. Definitely put that on a poster.
He's never sarcastic, as he marks it. but it was sort of like the sketches he did. Not, I mean, it wasn't. But the Doctor Who night, it was that sort of coming from a sideways look at things and being quite meta about things. So you know, I guess it was his sense of humour. So more than just a silly parody would have been, but. It just reminds me of all of those. I'm having to revisit those times because I'm finishing a book called Who's Playing Who, which is about the decade that we did the Doctor Who comedies in.
Yeah, I saw that on the internet.
Audience. But, and so because of having to revisit it, and every time I look in the Doctor Who Companion, it sort of reminds me of writing this sketch or you know, this actor exploding or, you know, etc. So it's sort of it's quite a comforting thing because it, you know, it contains, I can't remember how, what it goes up to, whether it goes up to the Eighth Doctor or whether it stops just before.
Yeah, well, it was published after the TV movie.
Yeah, it'll include the TV movie, which we got great trouble. Mileage at the TV movie in comedy terms, I think. It's a nice sort of Bible if you're, you know, you want to look. It's a bit like Wikipedia, isn't it, really? You can just look at it online now, but then I had to use an actual book. So
when we were doing the 50th and you get to the Eighth Doctor, we had a lot of fun because it was the 50th by that point, so we knew about the War Doctor, so we had the Eighth Doctor coming on and then Eccleston coming on going, "Oi, you know you're worried about being the Doctor Who Lazenby, off you go." And then the War Doctor coming in and cutting Eccleston down to size and all that sort of stuff. But and then McGann going off going, "What's audio drama?" and things like that. But in fact, that could be a segue into your next one, which is Whispers of Terror, let's just call it an early big finish because it's 1999.
I think, yeah.
That's a Gary Russell era directed.
Yeah. Very early on.
Very early on. It's when they used to have the sort of 25-minute episodes and the music. I think they had them. This one, I've listened to it the other day. Does it have it every 25 minutes?
It does, and it has the wrong theme tune. It has the Tom Baker theme tune.
And I bet you can tell he's wearing the wrong scarf.
Yeah, the wrong colour.
He's not wearing the costume in the booth. No good. it's one of the good things about this podcast is, especially with the Big Finish recommendations, because I mean, I've listened to a lot of Big Finish, obviously, but there are so many, especially from the early days. I mean, I had Joe Lidster, right? He put his own 2002 one down.
I like
Whispers of Terror. I hadn't listened to that before, and it's, you know, $2.99, a bargain.
Yes.
So yeah, I paid my $2.99 and got Whispers of Terror, and got an absolutely splendid splendid audio adventure, which I'm going to put a link to it in the notes, because it's a monster made of sound. So it is one of those.
Yeah. I think it's when you, because I started listening to Be Finished right at the start, and then as you do, or not everybody does, but sometimes you drift away and come back and listen.
Unless you're a millionaire, and you can buy them all.
And some people are. I mean, some people buy that, which is amazing. But you can sort of see the progression of how. I mean, I know they already were doing audio dramas as amateurs, and then came in to do this as professionals. But you can sort of hear the journey as you go through the stuff. And what I found fascinating about this was that simple concept of that it was an audio monster, basically. It was an oral antiquities museum, wasn't it? And so, I listened to it again not that long ago, and it sort of reminded me a little bit of The Silence in the Library, the Stephen Moffat.
Me too, yeah.
Yeah, I had that sort of feel. And it's just a really... I love Justin Richards, who's, I think, an underappreciated sort of writer, a bit in the Terence Dix mold. He's like the modern Terence Dix. I mean, he could just... He churned out loads, and it was always really interesting. That thing about being a page-turner, I think the Terence Dix thing of as long as you want to turn the page, that's a good story. It doesn't, you know, it might not be the best story in the world, but you're turning the page because you want to know what happens next. And Justin Richards was very like that in books, and this audio, I just thought he had a great concept. Whereas before, there'd been a couple of audios that had that awful dialogue of, oh, look, there's a monster with seven legs and it's walking on the right-hand side of the corridor coming down to us, and we're standing against a wall, but luckily there's a window behind us, so I'll just open it. Horrible explaining nature of audio, which is very easy to
that's the classic radio writing. The I think, I don't know if this ever happened, but everyone always says this is the gun I am holding in my left hand is loaded.
Yes.
from like Dick Barton or something.
Well, I remember a specific one, and I can't remember the title of the Big Finish story, but it was from, I think it was some sort of very well-known writer, about a piano being possessed in this and coming towards it. And it was properly described in that awful way of, you know, it's trundling down the left hand side of the ground, we must move to the right, and here it comes, you know, that sort of thing. And which is an easy mistake to make when you're writing audio, especially if you've not sort of written it before. But but Whispers of Terror, it's quite odd actually, because Whispers of Terror, because it does, obviously Colin Baker's had this massive renaissance as the Sixth Doctor in Big Finish, and has been able to develop the character where he wanted to go with it, which was a little less bickery and, you know, a little less sort of, not bumptious, that's the wrong word, but sort of...
One thing I noticed actually is they do still have that.
Yeah.
They've obviously had the thing, well, they always argued, so there is still that weird, why is she travelling with him? Why doesn't he kick her out the times? Why doesn't she leave?
That's the sort of a plus side of it, because it is basically, it sounds like it could have been a TV episode, because it is written exactly like they were like on TV. But there are some quite harsh arguments where you genuinely do think, I mean, you're just bullying Perry now. That's not nice. But it's remarkable how that's been changed. And the Sixth Doctor, you know, on audio has become something that Colin obviously always wanted it to be.
We can forget that he tried to strangle her. And...
Well, it's weird because he had that... I mean, it's a sort of a strange thing to do, had to have a long-term plan in your head and think, well, Tom Baker did it for 7 years, so if I can do sort of 3 or 4 years, I know how I want to develop the character. And obviously get nixed within like 18 months or whatever. And you just think, you know, that's a real shame. But... I find it comforting, because the Sixth Doctor was probably, although I grew up with Peter Davison, I was at that age when the Sixth Doctor was on of being, you know, peak Doctor Who fan, and really desperately, you know, everything was, I wanted everything, I was interested in everything, and so Colin Baker sort of, you know, it's the one that era, which is obviously much maligned, and so it's sort of quite a comforting thing.
It's much maligned by Colin himself, not all of it, obviously, but it's it's like, I've worked with him since, but I interviewed him 20 odd years ago,
Yeah.
And he was very complimentary about Big Finish and said it's a lot better than the rubbish I had to often had to contend with when out for the TV program.
Yeah.
But you know Colin, don't you?
I do, yes.
Have you worked with him or fandom or
strangely, he asked to be. We did our Doctor Who comedies. Towards the end, we were very kindly flown out to America to do the Gallifrey convention, the evening entertainment. So we did a big long play, and Colin at a performance and met up with him afterwards at the theatre. And he said, "Oh, what are you doing? Are you doing any more?" And we said, "Yeah, we're going to Gallifrey, and you're one of the guests there." And he said, "Oh, brilliant." He said, "Are you doing a play?" And I said, "Yeah." I said, "Can you write? Can I be in it?" And I said, yeah, obviously, if you want to be in it.
No. Only if you wear the right scarf.
And then I said, "What do you want to play? Obviously, you'll be playing the Sixth Doctor." And he said, "No, no." He said, can I play the Seventh Doctor?" And I went, "I don't know, really." And so we concocted the fact that he could. I said, "Well, rather than you playing this, why don't you play it? We'll write in Maxill, because then you can come, you know, it'll be like a nice twist for the audience expecting you to come out, you know, or if you do come out thinking, oh, you're right to play the Sixth Doctor." So he did that, and very kindly came out of the TARDIS on stage and said, "You know, I'm Commander Maxwell." I've genuinely never heard an audience react. It was like the Beatles. They literally were screaming for about 2 minutes before he could even say his line. And we sort of lost it on stage a bit. We got a bit sort of overly happy, and it was it was an amazing thing. Oh, yeah. So I worked with him in that sense, but also but that's the nice thing I think about being our age and being doing the stuff we do, that we can employ people that we absolutely loved when we were younger. So I was able to get him into I did an NHS Origins drama for Audible, and basically it was potted with Doctor Who. There's Colin May, there's Terry Malloy, there's Louise Jameson.
Yeah. Well, I've done a Ramsay Campbell adaptation, which I've been doing it for a long time because lockdown got in the way. And it's almost finished and it'll probably be out. I don't think it's quite going to be ready for Gallifrey 1 when we go out there, unfortunately. But I've got Peter Davison and Colin Baker and Louise Jameson and Mina Anwar. I was almost going, it's a horror. Have I put too many Doctor Who's in? But do you know what? Yes. Everyone's acting so amazingly, and they're not acting like they're in Doctor Who. And Colin Baker plays a blind old man, who's 100 and something, which he loved being playing really old. And he also had a cold, so he used that. it was absolutely amazing working with him over clean feed and,
He's very. I love because when
such a good actor.
When he did the NHS one, it was a real. Most of the people were real life people, and so he went off and obviously researched what the chap sounded like and came back and did sort of a really good interpretation of that. Rather than being Colin Baker, he just said, "Oh well, I'm going to do it like this because that's how he sounded." So, and that was really nice. Because I mean, you know, we didn't ask him to do that. He just sort of went off on his own and to find the character, which was really good. So I think the weirdest thing about, I suppose, and I don't know really, because it's that I think people assume that Doctor Who actors aren't versatile, I think that's why it's nice when they do theatre stuff and Doctor Who fans specifically go and watch plays because their Doctor is in it, and then they get to see them doing something different and being different than they were as the Doctor, which is great for an actor to be able to, you know, put on various things and have an audience because of their time in Doctor Who. But
Well, I also think that's one of the. I mean, it has been in my life, like not just Doctor Who, but just like loving that thing as a kid. Really has exposed me, like knowing, you know, I'm the generation, like I guess you are, Alec Guinness was Obi-Wan Kenobi first before it was anything, and that led to me watching when I was quite young, watching quite a lot of Alec Guinness healing comedies with my parents, and then watching The Man in the White Suit and Passport to Pimlico he's in anyway, Our Man in Havana, and just going, "Oh my God, he's just an amazing actor." And the same with John Hurt in Alien, which I watched when I was quite young, and then just watching anything with John Hurt in it. And
that's nice, though.
Finally getting to meet him and just sort of saying, you know,
yeah,
it's weird, it's Alien. Because of I watched Alien, I then watched Midnight Express because you were in it. And I watched the Quentin Blake thing, which he always said was the thing he was most proud of his entire career, doing the Naked Civil Servant on the TV was the one he always comes back to. And also The Elephant Man got me into David Lynch, and I watched it because I saw the name John Hurt and all these things you do. It's amazing. But I guess the doctors are like that. I mean, how many people have been to see Hamlet because David Tennant was in it or whatever?
And that's just incredible because it's enriching everybody who goes to watch stuff because they're going to watch their favorite doctor. But, you know, it's enriching their cultural lives because they're finding out new stuff. And a friend of mine said he would never have, you know, watched the plays he'd watched had it not been because, you know, Colin Baker or Sylvester McCoy was in it or whatever. And so he went to watch. I like the fact also you said that John Hurt played Quentin Blake, which was...
Quentin Blake.
You know,
Quentin Crisp.
He was very fine with the pen.
Yes.
A camp flourish to all his...
I interviewed Quentin Blake once. He was one of the most wonderful people I've ever... He's still with us, isn't he? I think.
Yeah, no, he's still... He very kindly... Because I republished...
Lovely gent.
he was offering his... He drew Agaton Sachs drawings.
Another one of your IP hoovering.
And it was Agaton Sachs. We did have a proper long conversation with Quentin Blake where he said, "You can, of course, you can reuse them, and you're a small company, so you know, don't worry about you know money and all that sort of stuff. We'll try and do it for." But then he couldn't find the original drawing, so we couldn't use them again because he just. I don't know. He obviously got rid of them at some point.
God.
But it was lovely. You know, he's a lovely, even somebody that big saying, just, you know, having the conversation and saying, oh, I would like to do that. You know, you're obviously, because I've just said, so we're not a massive company, we're a tiny publisher. And
lovely chap. Well, my main memory, I mean, this was again, I did a lot of interviews when I ran a magazine in Newcastle 20 odd years ago. Was the editor of a magazine. But my main memory is him being so delighted. I associated him even more than Roald Dahl with Mortimer the Crow. Because so often people just want to talk about the BFG, and I was like, oh, I just love those Mortimer the Crow books. Just absolutely love them. And started drawing Mortimer the Crow. Before we wrap up, I mean, your obviously audio... It sort of says you're an audio director, an audio writer is kind of what it says on your LinkedIn and things like that. So I guess Big Finish is, you know, you were, they've been one of the people keeping not just the Doctor Who flame alive, but the audio drama flame alive before this, before the internet came and really, you know, it's Radio 4. And Big Finish. And, you know, and now it's Dirk Maggs having Neil Gaiman Sandman on massive big, you know, video posters in Los Angeles. And
like it's astonishing, isn't it? I mean,
I mean, I've never actually worked with Dirk Maggs. I've had a project in development with him for far too long, an IP that then fell apart. No fault of Dirk's, just one of those things. But I've got to sort of know him through doing that, and he's an absolutely wonderful, inspiring person. But you've actually worked with him
he very kindly. I think it is his fault. I'm going to blame him entirely that I went into audio drama because I was I did. I'm Sorry, Read That Again, which is an old BBC comedy. I wanted to do it on stage as a radio thing, and I can't remember why I was in touch with Dirk. And I can't remember why now, but I just said, look, I don't know how to get in touch with the BBC about licensing. I'm Sorry, Read That Again or whatever. And he just said, well, why don't I email Graham Garden for you? And I went, oh, that would be a nice way to do it. And so because of that, it sort of snowballed and off the back of that, we did other stuff. He's one of those people. It's a bit like Barry. People always say about Barry Cryer, he was never interested in looking back. He always said, you know, comedy is the funniest now. I love these new comedians and et cetera, et cetera. And Dirk looks very much like that about stuff. He's always encouraging. He's always, you know, saying it took him a long, long time to get where he is and to be, you know, as renowned as he is. And so he's always there to help other people, which is an amazing thing, really, because he's not precious about, oh, I must retain my crown as the king of audio. He just is happy to help and collaborate, which is, yeah, I mean, it's lovely to find somebody like that, isn't it? As you all know, having, you know, had stuff in development with him, but he is a very, a ball of energy. So
just a total inspiration, and I mean, his Hitchhikers. I think I saw you comment on one of his comments on Facebook that you didn't realize till now that how many things of his you'd watched, listened to.
Yeah.
Like his, you know, nearly everything you really loved turned out to have Dirk behind it.
Yeah.
Like the Flywheel and Schuster, yeah. And was it the Marx Brothers? Yeah, was that the Marx Brothers one? Yeah, and all those sort of amazing things.
It's a bit
the same here with, like, I love my Hitchhikers. Yeah. That's the one thing I do have in common with lots of Doctor Who fans. I absolutely adore Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Yeah.
And so I didn't register who Dirk Maggs was when it all came back. But then it was like, when they did the live version, I was like, I couldn't get enough of that.
Yeah. Did you see the live version?
Yeah, a couple of times, yeah.
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah. Johnny Vegas as the book, which was, that was an interesting book. It's like as far from Peter Jones as you could get. It was brilliant. It was Manchester as well, so it was a very bawdy crowd.
Oh, fantastic.
That was brilliant, yeah. But, I think Dirk would probably run a mile at the suggestion, but considering how it ended and things, which he's quite open about, because I was listening to a podcast the other day in which it hospitalised him. He said, the stress of the arseholes that produced it. I think he said
it is horrendous, isn't it? I mean, it's a sad because it was going so wow and being so well loved by everybody that was watching it. A horrible end to something that was such a lot of fun.
So often the way though. It's like like Stuart Lee and Jerry Springer the Opera.
Became
an absolute nightmare. These huge hits and the human cost behind them is horrendous. But your own career. So one thing that I've got a few of your Robin of Sherwood audios, which are interesting.
Sorry about that.
but Robin of Sherwood for me was I mean, I think I was, it was very much ITV trying to do the Doctor Who. Having something for kids at that time, and it was one of the few times I did turn over for ITV, because my dad worked for the BBC and we had this weird BBC house, and we don't, and my parents were very much, don't watch that, it's got adverts on it, it's for peasants. my mum uses the word peasants way too much, and so, you know, somebody's, oh, they were talking about Coronation Street, peasants. And I've grown up with this weird snobbery, which I try and fight against, and I realised how many things I missed. Like, I didn't see Children of the Stones because it was on ITV, things like that. But there was something very prestigious about Robin of Sherwood.
It was amazing.
I think it had quite a big budget for the time, didn't it?
It was the biggest budget of its time, because it had external funding from Goldcrest, a film company. So I think it was I don't know the exact figures, but it was huge, and the only reason it didn't continue was because Goldcrest pulled the funding, as they had a few film flops and they just couldn't afford to continue on. Otherwise, I think it would have run. It certainly would have run a couple more series, if not more. But
they even had a regeneration as well, so it really was. It really was sort of set up to. He's magically changed his face.
Yeah,
and everyone's fine with it.
But it was a huge thing for in my childhood. But again, it came about the same way as Doctor Who, in the sense that when I revisited Doctor Who, doing the comedies, some people that had employed me were doing a Robin of Sherwood convention, and said, "Can you do a comedy spoof like you've done for Doctor Who for a Robin Sherwood convention, like, you know, condense the whole thing into an hour and a half or whatever. And because of that, I then had to obviously rewatch Robin Sherwood, you know, look into all the backstage stuff, look at all the documentaries and whatever on the DVDs. And that sort of reignited my love for it. And so I, yeah, so it was a weird connection coming off the comedy. You know, you get back into to loving what the original thing was in the first place. So, it's a joy to be able to do things like to bring back original cast for things. I mean, it's like Big Finish with Doctor Who. It's just a coup whenever people say yes to coming back. You don't expect, or they probably won't do it. And then they say, I mean, we were very lucky with Ray Winston in that he did the very first one that we did because he played Will Scarlet in Robin Sherwood, but he hasn't. But John Coulshaw took over afterwards because obviously Ray's incredibly busy and was never around when we were going to record stuff. And John Coulshaw, he's just such amazing. A pitch perfect.
Every voice he tries, he's Brigadier.
He's astonishing. And so, so we've been lucky that we've had him, and it's not been, you know, and all the cast were happy to for that to happen. And so, yeah, so it's been an interesting ride. It's a bit like doing. We recently did the John Nathan Turner audio, which
is
the connection.
I was moving towards.
It all comes from, you know, that place of childhood, because one of my favourite Seventh Doctor stories is Paradise Towers and the Greatest Show in the Galaxy is my absolute favourite, the Seventh Doctor, and both written by Stephen Wyatt, and just sort of vaguely getting to know him, he then pitched this thing of, you know, can we do an audio drama about Doctor Who producer Jonathan Turner, his last couple of years of his life with his partner. And so we said, yeah, I said, yeah, that seems like quite a nice thing to do.
Obviously we at Cutaway know Stephen. He's been very much involved with, Sean Mason's writing it, but he's been very much involved in approving and giving permission and interviews and publicity. And we've had some lovely lunches with him. He's absolutely as well, I don't need to tell you, but for the listeners, he is a gorgeous, gorgeous human being. I love Stephen.
He's very nice.
He really is good. And I'm very much looking forward to hearing the audio. Does it arrive? In December the 17th, I've got it in my head.
I think it could well be. You're probably right. Because it's a limited edition CD, and I think next year you can get it as a download and stuff as well. But that'll be. But it's not, the Cutaway Comics stuff is amazing. So it's lovely to sort of have that. We're all vaguely connected in some way at some point.
Yeah, yeah.
At some point, I will muscle my way into.
We will. At the beginning. I'm sure we will. Cross pollination will commence. But I don't know why I said cross pollination. I think it's because I got vervoids in my head because I was thinking about that Colin being that age when Colin Baker era. Yeah. But it's been absolutely wonderful talking to you, Barnaby, as I knew it would be.
Thank you.
I've never met you before, and now you are, but pixels on a Zoom screen. But I just kind of knew how many different things we all had in common, and as expected, we have jumped around from Buddhism.
Sorry about that.
No, it's wonderful. I love it, and I will let you know when I put this out. And for everyone listening, I will put links to your. How many businesses have you got? Your 50 imprints. I'll put links to the main ones where people can buy stuff off you. Go and have a look. But that's been absolutely wonderful.
Joy.
And
thank you very much. I'm humbled that you asked me. So
it's good.
I don't get asked very often. So.
Oh well, I don't know why. It's
as I waffle, that's probably
it's a podcast. It's a podcast. If people are listening to this, then they are very much into listening to people talking about Doctor Who. I'm basically just making this for the sort of thing that I listen to so many Doctor Who podcasts now. I've become addicted, and there can never be too many. So
you've added an extra one.
I've added an extra one.
Yeah.
And it's and I always like it when people are being interviewed, because sometimes if you do get three guys talking about their opinions on an episode, that can sometimes get a bit, okay, I can probably live without listening to this. But an interview is an interview, isn't it? Anyway, I'm waffling on now. This is the bit which will be, I'll say goodbye and fade out, and we'll just be carry on yapping, and it'll, and the music will be kicking in now. But yeah, that's been absolutely wonderful, Barnaby.
No, thank you very much, Ian.
I'm sure we'll work together at some point. I'm going to stop recording now.
You have been listening to The Bunker from Cutaway Universe. Your host has been Ian Winterton, produced by James Steventon of Bamalan Productions. Gods and Monsters advert voiced by Brian Blessed. All music by Paul Phillips. For more on Cutaway and to buy online, visit cutawaycomics.co.uk or follow us on Twitter @cutawaycomics.